In the words of billionaire H.L. Hunt, remember that money is just a way of keeping score. Make money your god, and it will plague you like the devil. Is the love of money the root of all evil? Welcome to Your Money and Your Life on Mind's Eye Radio. I'm your host, Cole Hornaday. Mind's Eye Radio is a program tuned to the sounds of social change. It's written and produced by the Mind's Eye Radio Collective in Madison, Wisconsin. In this hour, we explore the topic of money from both a reverent and irreverent view. We'll hear from the coins of the realm, have some plain talk about safe money, and get a kid's eye view of how much things cost. Stay with us, won't you? Our personal relationship to money is rarely spoken of, making it perhaps the most taboo subject in America. Sue Renard wondered what would happen if a well-known talk show host decided to change all that.
Ladies and gentlemen, Dr. Ruth here. Welcome to my new show, Intimate Money. Now that sex is no longer taboo, it's sex, sex, sex all the time. It's time to talk about what is really the most intimate subject in America, personal finance. Just call 1-888-555-CASH. And here's our first caller, Bettina, are you there?
Oh, Dr. Ruth, thank you for taking my call. I'm desperate.
What seems to be the problem, Bettina?
I was at my boyfriend's house last night. We've only been dating a few weeks now. And I saw his pay stub lying on a table. Oh, Dr. Ruth, I learned that I make more money than he does. What do I do now?
First, let me remind you that it's not the size of a man's paycheck that's important. What else did you learn?
I couldn't help myself. I read everything. His gross pay, deductions, automatic withdrawals.
The real issue now is whether you're ready to get serious with this man. In a mature relationship, both partners should be equals. So, the question is whether you're ready to show him your pay stub.
I don't know. It's too soon. I don't want to get that committed.
Well, 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 it's a little too late for regrets, Bettina. The cat is out of the bag. Your only option now is to be open and honest with your boyfriend or drop him like a hot potato. Okay, on to our next caller. Carlos from Jersey City.
Dr. Ruth, thanks for taking my call. I don't know what to do. Last week, I met my girlfriend for dinner, and she comes in smiling and laughing, and she says she's got this inheritance from a great aunt and wanted some investment advice.
And what happened then?
She asked me if she should go for an aggressive international mutual fund or municipal bonds, treasuries. Dr. Ruth, I'm an investment virgin. I don't know, a T-bill from a T-bone. Should I tell her?
Oh, there's nothing embarrassing about being financially naive, Carlos. Most people know a lot less about money than you think.
What can I do?
I suggest you and your fiancé read books together, like The Joy of Money. Sign up for an investment course that will strengthen your relationship. Oh, our next caller is from Mobile. Charlene, are you there?
What a privilege to talk to you, Dr. Ruth. Great program. I love my husband very, very much, but I have to admit that he doesn't please me financially. He has his passbook, checkbook, and one credit card, and that's it.
And what's wrong with that, Charlene?
I want more, much more. I've tried separate accounts, joint accounts, even cyber banking. I brought home some portfolios and tried to get my husband to go in with other couples in an investment club, but he won't have it. I'm dollar cost averaging on my no-load mutual fund, if you know what I mean, and my husband refuses to use the drive-up Taylor window.
This is a difficult problem, Charlene. It's possible that you and your husband are fiscally incompatible. Did you talk about money before you got married?
No, I thought it would all just work out somehow.
A common mistake, Charlene. People who have different attitudes towards money often have trouble in their marriage. I suggest you see an investment counselor where you can each talk openly about your monetary needs.
And if that doesn't work, Dr. Ruth?
Then you get some money-scented perfume and cover your bed in new $20 bills. Okay, on to our final caller of the evening. Here's Lee from Omaha. What can I do for you, Lee?
Dr. Ruth, I'm in a terrible state. Yesterday, my 13-year-old asked me about ATM cards. What should I do?
Well, have you talked to your children about money yet?
Well, I tried once, but I didn't know how. I thought they were too young.
It's never too early to talk to your kids about money, Lee. A lot of adolescents get into trouble because they don't know how to handle financial pressures at school, and they end up bankrupting the whole family.
But what would I tell him at his age?
The most important message at his age is to emphasize safe money.
What do you mean?
Money can be very exciting, but it can also be dangerous. For one thing, you need to tell your son that every time he touches a dollar bill, he's touching everyone who ever touched that bill.
What else does he need to know?
Well, bring your ATM card and show him how to slip it in and out of its protective sleeve. You also need to emphasize that he has to take responsibility for his money and that he shouldn't get serious about it until he's older. Well, caller, that's all we have time for tonight. Thanks for listening to Intimate Money. And remember, nothing is too personal about personal finance. Until next time, this is Dr. Ruth.
With his inimitable eloquence, Yogi Berra once said, "A nickel ain't worth a dime anymore." In thinking about the value of money, Dick Radke found himself in total agreement with Mr. Berra.
Change isn't what it used to be. Change. This kind of change. My Uncle George liked to say that all a man needed to get along in the world was a shine on his shoes and a jingle in his pocket. Half a century ago, that idea had a grain of truth in it. Today, a pocket full of change does nothing but wear a hole in your pants. Times have changed in the commerce of change. Back in 1949, even a penny was worth something. I collected pennies on the advice of my cousin Tom, who swore that a 1909 SVBD penny was worth $10,000. If I could find just one SVBD, my fortune would be made. Pennies were passing through my fingers every day. Surely one of them would carry the magic inscription. 1949, and change was literally coin of the realm. Kids saw folding money only at birthdays, a dollar or two tucked inside a card from a godmother, a $5 bill from Grandma at Christmas. It was those small, round discs of copper, nickel, and silver that drove our everyday economy. In 1949, a penny bought licorice whips or jelly beans at Rico's Sweet Shop, candy dots stuck to strips of paper, tiny bottles of colored sugar water, gumballs, chiclets, jawbreakers from the machine out front. A penny bought a stick of gum, a pair of wax lips, a cat's eye marble. Sent postcards as far away as California. A nickel bought a phone call at the payphone at the IGA store, a ride on the number 57 bus out to State Fair Park, where for another nickel you could try your luck at a game of chance on the Midway. A nickel bought a 6-ounce bottle of Coke from a vending machine. A nickel had heft. It was thick and smooth and dense. Start a nickel collection 1 week and give it up the following week when you're forced to rate it to meet current expenses. And the dime. A dime was worth more than a nickel or a penny, but it weighed less and went begging for respect. One thin dime got you into the Saturday afternoon matinee at the Paradise Theater for a double feature of Roy Rogers and Johnny Mac Brown. It bought a double-sized Baby Ruth candy bar at the concession counter or a Zane Grey pocketbook at the drugstore. A dime was subtle, its importance understated in size and heft. A quarter was real money. A quarter got you into the toy section at Ben Franklin to choose among yo-yos, model airplanes, race cars, six-shooters, collections of lead soldiers carrying carbines, machine guns, bazookas. The half dollar. The half dollar was seen only in the hands of uncles who flipped it between their knuckles as part of a repertoire of magic tricks. Half dollars were a dangerous denomination, for they cried out to your mother to be deposited in your bank account, where they disappeared forever, waiting for something known as a rainy day. Plenty of rainy days came and went, but never a glimpse of those missing half dollars. The silver dollar. Seen only occasionally, and not change in the conventional sense, far too valuable to be spendable, with its beautiful Lady Liberty on one side and the fierce E. Pluribus Eagle on the other, an object to be admired, not spent, a piece of jewelry, an heirloom. 50 years later, my collection of pennies, nickels, and dimes is housed in a ragu spaghetti jar. Once a year, I take the jar to the bank and exchange it for a set of crisp new dollar bills. Change has changed. Like the buggy whip and the coal-burning furnace, its day is passing. Plastic cards are the new medium for everything from gas pumps to movie tickets. And in the process, we're losing something. Who would dare claim that all a man needs to get along is a shine on his shoes and the jingle of plastic in his pocket? And what boy would dare dream of making his fortune by finding a 1909 SVBD credit card on his way home from school? So, change has changed, but has it changed for the better? This is Dick Radke for Mind's Eye Radio.
Whatever the value of money, in reality, it represents many things to each of us. Money can be an addiction, and all addictions have a cost. Paying for them sometimes means taking a moral nosedive that's truly Olympic class. As Greg Willard tells in his story, Old Copper Nose.
He had almost worked his finger in far enough to coax out the bill. He prayed it was at least a 10 when his daughter turned on the light. "What are you doing with my piggy bank?" His face, white with tense anticipation of a drink, stung with the sudden flush of shame and rage. He imagined his smile as ghoulishly unconvincing. I was just giving you a little present. Why were you putting it in from the bottom?" She hadn't moved from the doorway. Her lower lip quivered, and she was blinking fast against tears. "Come here, honey." She didn't move. He put down the piggy bank reluctantly. It was hefty enough with change and paper money, he guessed, to get him several six-packs and a fifth, but made out of an unbreakable, hell, it was invulnerable, thick pink plastic. You were stealing my money." "Oh, honey, I wouldn't do that." He laughed and almost believed it. "I didn't want to bother you. I put in a coin, and then I realized it was the wrong coin." Her expression hardened, but she tilted her head and met his eyes. "Ah," he thought, "she's curious. I've got her." She walked to the piggy bank and cradled it, like a football, in the crook of her arm. The shifting coins inside clattered enticingly. "What kind of coin?" His mind raced. He was long overdue for a drink, pills, anything, seeing double with a migraine. It's hard to explain. "I'm telling Mom." "Don't do that. Let me explain. A long time ago in England, the coins of the realm, of the kingdom, were supposed to be made of silver. But you see, the king, Henry VIII, he was real greedy, see? So he was the king who was fat. He cut the queen's head off." "Yeah, he was fat. He ate venison and, well, you know, I don't know if he cut her head off or..." She sat on the bed and kicked her feet, humming a menacing song with the lyrics, "I'm going to tell Mom you're stealing money again. Listen to the story." So the big fat King Henry was greedy for money, like you. The big fat King Henry was greedy for money. So what he did was, he had the royal mint, the royal moneymakers that shave a little tiny bit of the silver from each coin in the realm. And then he put it all in bags and he melted it down into big silver bars that were worth lots of money. Well, you know what happened. I'm telling Mom, don't you want to know what happened to the money in old England? She sighed and twisted her hair, but stayed put. Well, the coins in old England got thinner and thinner and thinner. The king got fatter. That's right. So the coins got so thin that the people were starting to be able to see light through these coins, like they were about as thin as, like a fly's wing or a piece of tissue paper. Well, you can imagine the trouble, the upset that the peasants experienced all over the kingdom. Well, the people were, they were walking into potholes in the street because they weren't looking where they were going, and they were holding the coins up to the light to check to see if they were thin enough for the light to seep through, and therefore, no good. So when the peasants and the pirates would bite into the coins to see if they were real metal like they did in those days, why, you can imagine what a terrible public health problem it was for thousands of British citizens to have this toxic metallic wafer that was breaking off in their mouths and going into their bloodstreams and producing mutated, deformed children with twisted bodies and hair falling out and everything. Well, there was going to be a revolution. So what the king did was, he started mixing copper, which was a whole lot cheaper than all silver, pure silver coins. He started mixing that in with the silver. I mean, he had his royal moneymakers make the coins out of copper with only a real thin coating of the silver to make the peasants and the pirates think that what they had was really silver instead of just a silver covering of a mostly copper coin. And then he could keep all the silver that was supposed to go into the coins. But what happened was the peasants and the pirates, when they were handling this money for a while, how long? Well, I don't know, just a while, a few days. After a few days, see, of handling this money, the thin silver coating started to rub off, and the people realized that the coins were really copper underneath the silver. What did the peasants and the pirates do? They called King Henry Old Copper Nose. He watched breathlessly as she considered the story. Finally, she asked, "Is the coin that you put in my bank one of those coins?" The question startled him. He'd completely forgotten the point of the story. He searched his daughter's face as she searched his. Her nearly horizontal pigtails, the grime on her fingers and cheeks from playing outside, these things glowed with an inner, radiant light. Finally, she promised not to tell. He left the room shaking. His next stop was the extra purse his wife usually left in the kitchen. He could almost taste his next drink. This is Greg Willard with Mind's Eye Radio.
In modern society, money no longer has much intrinsic value. Coins are made of common metals, bills are just pieces of paper, which leaves poet Fran Rawl wondering what is real about reals anymore.
Real reals. 2 bits and 4 bits, my father used to say. Silver dollars cut across twice. He didn't bite them, but they used to, and nicked the edges to see if they were all silver. Spanish reals. They sang of the silver river which flowed into solid silver thrones and crouched lions, almost life-sized. Very solid banking, that. Coins are still round, but the reality is gone. Money flows from country to country, account to account. People depend on it, but maybe it's just monopoly money, like I used to have in my toy box. This is Fran Rawl for Mind's Eye Radio.
Where do you keep your hard-earned cash that you haven't frittered away? Some 90 years ago, the first credit union in America began operation in Manchester, New Hampshire, serving French-speaking textile mill workers. Paul Thompson pays tribute to the more than 11,000 financial service cooperatives in the U.S. and their 75 million members in his poem, The Credit Union Waltz.
Mary, sweet Mary, come dance with me, Mary. I'll always be true, never false. The dancers are swaying, the orchestra's playing the beautiful Credit Union Waltz. My checking is growing, and soon I'll be going to shop for a sparkling band. Then I will kneel, love, and softly appeal, love, to you to accept my hand. When we need the bucks for the gown and the tux, a credit union card buys a lot. With borrowing so handy, we'll look oh so dandy the day we tie the knot. We'll draw up a budget, and we'll never fudge it. We'll save for the future today. With payroll deduction, it's not a production to put part of each paycheck away. That egg in our nest, someday we'll invest in a little white house with a fence. With a credit union mortgage, it won't take us ages to pay off this major expense. We'll first have a girl and then have a boy and a dog with a collar and bone. They'll all go to college to be filled with knowledge on a guaranteed student loan. And when we retire, we won't sit by the fire, thanks to our IRA. We'll lambada all night as we cruise the moonlight, sailing to Montego Bay. This is Paul Thompson for Mind's Eye Radio.
It's impossible to talk about money without also talking about what we value in life. Poet Esther Cameron gives us two sonnets with very different viewpoints on the role of money.
The first sonnet, Money Magic, refers back to a time that is now difficult to remember. Back in the 60s and 70s, you really could meet your basic needs by working 40 hours a week at a simple job. Thus, we really didn't have to scrape for food or rent. Do you recall when we were poor together? We'd sit and talk like counselors of kings, of art and soul and world and why and weather, drinking cheap Chianti among curious things gleaned from goodwill, from beaches where we went. But everything was cheaper in those days. We didn't have to scrape for food or rent. These met, we could feel wealthy in a phrase. It is the old story, you have grown rich, and never visit now and seldom call, leaving us to mull those spells that leech life's substance, and to patch affection's hole as best we can with what we still can buy, the cost of your replacement being too high. The second sonnet was written after I'd looked at Adam Smith's basic text of Laissez-faire economics. In the early chapters, he makes the point how basic economic activity is to human existence. That started me thinking about all the anti-money statements poets have made over the centuries, like Jean Garrigue's Money is the Devil's Word. And the following sonnet is the result of my meditations. The tendency to barter, truck, exchange, said Adam Smith, distinguishes the human from all the other animals that range in social groups and find their food in common. The strong may rob the weaker, or the weak beg from the strong, but neither thinks to pay the other for the benefit they seek. This is, as much as speech, the human way. Then why do poets castigate the coin, and coin so seldom visit poets' purse? Are we the baby chimp, the big-eyed whine, still striving to appoint the world its nurse? Unless we speak for earth, from whom all wares are taken, and for all of barter's heirs. This is Esther Cameron for Mind's Eye Radio.
Coming up next on Mind's Eye Radio, we'll be urged to fight the lure of money and hear about the dangers of lending money to friends and relatives. Stay tuned. If it weren't for Parade magazine, few of us would know how much others make. No matter how hard we try to convince ourselves that money doesn't matter, the fact is, many measure their value by how much money they make.
Admitted non-millionaire Gay Davidson Zilski finds herself trying to fight this stereotype with some help from the younger set.
About once a year, my Sunday is ruined when from the folds of a newspaper drops Parade magazine with its bleak cover story headline, "What People Earn." I would much rather see the toothy, wholesome, smiling face of Gwyneth Paltrow, who is probably already making 30 times my teaching salary for the loathsome chore of acting out make-believe parts in front of a panting audience. But no, instead I am taunted by the always smiling countenances of ordinary people, guys and gals next door, innocently stating for all the world to see their salaries, that holiest of holy secrets. Groaning, I discover that one Ernestine O, who runs a resale shop, pulls down 57,000 clams a year. Not bad for peddling used trousers. Helen Hunt makes a cool $31 million, but she's royalty. So far off my radar scope, she's practically mythical. So I don't feel too bad about that comparison. But what's this? A preacher in Rockville, Maryland, who makes $57,000 a year too? I thought persons of the cloth were supposed to work for firewood and homemade pies in the greater glory of their chosen deities. I stop reading details and start counting. Just as I feared, 31 out of 45 workers make more than I do. Oh well, I still make more than most of the world's people. I can afford the occasional splurge on a cute little hat or a pair of shoes or a jumbo pack of toilet paper. But Steven Spielberg made in the neighborhood of $175 million last year for playing with toys and shooting pictures of them. Pretty good neighborhood, that. But then, even Mr. Rogers' neighborhood is far ritzier than mine. So once a year, I get depressed all over again about my salary shortfalls. But at least my son Alex feels financially secure. He once amused good friends of ours by informing them that his dad and I keep a couple of million dollars stashed around the house, and that we would live in the mansion we own, but we don't like to show off. These good friends now never miss an opportunity to ask for a loan of a few $100,000 to tide them over until payday. Our societal weirdness about money permeates most dealings. For example, I commute daily with a full professor. But even after years of sharing our most intimate thoughts about our families, religion, the Clintons, and sex, I don't know precisely what she earns, and she is far too classy to ask me. So, though adults may only have vague ideas about what other people earn, you can be sure they do know what things cost. They encounter this brutal truth daily at the cappuccino shop, paying the babysitter, taking out that line of personal credit, getting the credit card statement beginning with the cheery words, "Perhaps you have overlooked the following debt," and ending, "If you have already paid this bill, please ignore the above statement." I plan to ignore it anyhow, but it's nice to have permission. Children, on the other hand, are sometimes shielded from the bitter truth on both ends of the spectrum. I visited a local after-school child care agency, and I talked to some 8 to 10-year-olds to see what they know about these burning questions. What do people earn? And what do things cost? What do you think a teddy bear salesman would make per year? A
couple thousand.
Well, it kind of depends on the quality of the bear and the size of the company.
Okay, how about Michael Jordan?
He makes, I think, about a couple million a year.
It depends on the year, like if they use him in commercials, then he can make like over $100 million or something.
What do you think the President of the United States makes?
Like, maybe a couple million.
I'm guessing from 5 million, billion, to 1 trillion.
How surprised would you be to find out he probably only makes about 200,000?
I think it's just plain weird.
Why would you say that? Why do you think the president should make more than Michael Jordan?
Because he is more famous and Michael Jordan is retired.
Because he makes the decisions for the United States of America, and Michael Jordan just plays basketball. That's all.
He makes more money because of the fans, and there's not like Bill Clinton wear. Like, and there's like Michael Jordan jerseys. So he wouldn't make as much money.
What about a teacher?
I think a couple hundred a month.
I think the teacher would make about
from $1,000 to $2,000 a year.
If your parents wanted to buy a three-bedroom house in Madison, what do you think they might pay?
Well, I'd guess, but like $9.8
million. 100,000,000.
What about a new American-made car, like something like a Saturn or maybe a minivan or something?
My grandma just bought a minivan, so I have sort of an idea. And it certainly depends on the dealer that you buy it from, too, and whether it's used or not. And I'd say around $250,000.
I think a new car, if you're renting it, I'd say $1,000 to $2,000. If you are buying it, probably $90,000 or so.
A brand new car?
Yeah.
Is it American or Japanese?
It's American.
$78,000.
Maybe $30,000, $20,000 range.
How much does a can of Pepsi cost?
About $1. $1.03.
A can?
Yeah.
Can from
regular
like a
can.
Soda machine?
Yeah.
60 cents.
$1.50 or 60 cents.
How about 6 bags of groceries when your parents go to the grocery store?
$220.
$40.
I'd say about $180.
I don't know, like 60, 70.
If you had $1,000,000, what's the first thing you would buy?
A ton of video games. That's a hard one.
An SVGA card, sound card, video card, $500,000 in the stock market, and then the rest I'd probably use for home usage.
What's the kind of thing that money can't buy?
Friendship.
Being happy with who you are and friendship.
I was going to say friendship.
Money can't buy, money can't buy, money can't buy free stuff.
You've been listening to a group of 8 to 10-year-olds at an after-school daycare center in Madison, Wisconsin. I asked them what people earn and what things cost. This is Gay Davidson-Zelsky for Mind's Eye Radio.
You're listening to Your Money and Your Life on Mind's Eye Radio. In the interest of fair play, it must be said that this show was written by people who, by choice or circumstance, are part of the 90% of society that controls only 10% of the wealth. And most of us, if asked, would probably gladly switch places with those in the wealthiest 10% group. But Mark von Karstadt urges us to avoid the lure of money.
Money. We talk about it, lie and fight about it, curse it, waste it, cherish it, and most of us wish we had more of it. It's an important facet in our consumer-driven economy, yet it's not all it's cracked up to be. Many people, including myself, who pursue the pot of gold, forget that it does not bring happiness. In fact, some of us neglect the examples provided in our own lives and place money as the highest priority. Rather, just living and appreciating the most precious gifts of all, personal time and time with those we love, should be our highest priority. My wife and I have a young daughter. We live fairly modestly in a suburban home we purchased for $95,000. And I'm fortunate to be paid a full salary and benefits for working only 4 days a week. The extra time I have with my family is precious. Every Monday, while most people are returning to the grind, I get to extend our weekend visits or just stay home with our daughter. Sounds like a pretty good deal, doesn't it? Yet, I find myself frequently saying, if I only had more money, we could get a bigger house, a new station wagon, or take that trip to Nepal. Sometimes, I just need to reflect on a few personal experiences and friends who had tons of cash, yet knew that money isn't the answer, to be reminded about where my priorities need to be. Rob was what most people considered a wealthy, self-made man. He had his own private plane, a Range Rover, a Ferrari, several million in the bank, thousands of acres of productive land, beautiful children, and a much younger second wife. Yet something was missing. Once, when we were driving to one of his properties, he asked me if I knew what the most precious thing was. After a moment of silence,
Rob pointed to the digital clock on the dashboard and said, "Time." He went on to say he had spent his entire adult life and all his time building his empire, making lots of money to do the things he never had time to do. He wasn't enjoying life and the people he loved. Maybe it was chemistry, or maybe it was this realization which led to bouts of depression. When his second wife talked about divorce, he felt his empire was threatened, and he became despondent. He said that he'd wasted his whole life focusing on money. 3 months later, he took his own life. So many of us, including myself, regularly say, if we only had more money, we wouldn't have as many problems. We could do what we really want, focus on doing good things for others, and be truly happy. In the mid-1980s, my friend Bob retired as an executive vice president of a global pharmaceutical company. He's a wealthy man, with contacts around the world. I asked him if he knew how much money was enough for a person to retire early and live in a manner which would allow him or her to buy and do whatever they wanted. He told me that he and the chief financial officer of his former company had pondered the same question. After a fairly in-depth analysis, they figured that a person would need to have in excess of $10 million in liquid assets. This amount, they thought, would last a lifetime of fairly extravagant, yet not foolish living. Sometimes, I'd dwell on what Bob figured out and think, if I only had that amount of money, I'd be happy. I start getting seduced all over again by money's charm and myth. But then, I remember it doesn't work that way. The lure of money and all its myths of power and value can suck a person in. It is seductive. The pursuit or fantasy of it does lead me to believe that it can cure all ills, replenish the spirit, or satisfy desires. It can satisfy some desires, and it can definitely satisfy most of our material needs, but it can't even come close to the value of time spent in the arms of a lover, or watching the sunset, or a beautiful waterfall. Money's lure can boost our internal drive to succeed as we are drawn in by its mythical power, but once obtained, it leaves us empty and unfulfilled. So with that thought in mind, I guess I'll stick with my 4-day work week and more time with my wife, daughter, family and friends, and time to think about the money I don't have and what I'd do with it if I had it. This is Mark James von Karstadt for Mind's Eye Radio.
There is an old proverb that most people consider thrift a fine virtue. Humans are, it seems, natural spendthrifts who find it easier to spend money than to earn it. Or perhaps we're just following the example of nature, as poet Jackie Wilson describes in her poem, Spendthrift Autumn.
Autumn leaves spill down over a roof to the pocket of yard below, generous currency scattered to whoever will value it. This is Jackie Wilson for Mind's Eye Radio.
They put you in this course that teaches you how to fill out applications.
As I am to you, and how you can get up what we call the ladder of success.
In any case, you're going to have a difficult time. No matter what race you are, it's very difficult to make it from the lower class to the middle class. And there's a number of reasons for that. If you're in the lower class, you're usually just scrambling for survival. Survival means putting food in your mouth. That it's very difficult just to get by on a day-to-day basis. You know, clothes, food, making it to the next sunrise. In order to make it from one class to the next, you need education. And in order to have education, you need the luxury of some free time when you're not thinking about where the next meal is coming from or working. So it's a lot harder when you're in a survival mode to find time to get educated. Once you get educated, your earning power is still a lot less if you're not a white male, okay? So your chances don't look too great. That's not to discourage you. Go ahead, kid, try it. Pull yourself up. I know you can do it.
And the first job you get, the hamburger cooker.
Flip hamburgers.
Flip hamburgers.
Flip Burger King. McDonald's.
Flip hamburgers.
Carl's.
Push Taco Bell.
McDonald's.
Burger Flip King. Flip hamburgers.
McDonald's or Burger King.
McDonald's.
Go to Carl's.
Taco Bell.
McDonald's. Burger King. Go to McDonald's or Burger King.
If you gamble every day, out of 365 days a year, there is a big chance that there's one day out of that 365 that's going to be your lucky day. Maybe all your biorhythms line up or something, you know, your intellectual and all that, you know, line up, and then you're going to hit it. Come back from lunch and be a millionaire and tell your boss, say, hey, you know, I'll see you later. And you want to work for me now? If possible, are you selling any stock or something? You want to work for me now? I mean, you know, I would just like to be like you and sit back and just watch that money roll in.
The money in narcotics is so astronomical. You know, when you're sitting here and you're looking at that coffee cup full of cocaine, it's worth $10,000. You know,
why take a job making $5
an hour? That's enough to turn anybody's head.
Well, you can make $1,000 in a day.
Well, I mean, it's probably worth it more than that. It's probably worth $100,000.
I've been broke so long. One of these days, I'm going to hit it. I just know it. You know, someday, you know.
Now, like, we'll go in the store and get 25 cartons of cigarettes. You've got a shopping cart, and you put 25 cartons of cigarettes in that shopping cart, okay? And you got bread and milk over it, you know. I come by behind you, and I put the cartons of cigarettes in here, you know. Laundry bag, like you have to go to cleaners and get your come on a hanger with the paper, cellophane paper, and your clothes all hung up in there. Well, see, that's fake pockets, bag pockets, you know. And I'll go through the checkpoint. I'll buy a pack of cigarettes. You see what I'm saying? And I got $250 worth of cigarettes on the hanger thing.
If I got a lot of money, I don't want this guy's money. If I'm broke, he's in tough shape. You always try to have a lot of ones. Stuff like that. And here again, it depends. You got to keep the conversation flowing. You know, that's the important part. And make some comment like, Jake, got all these ones, and it looks like a Detroit bankroll. Why don't you give me a 10 for this one?
Did they count the 9?
And say, there's only 9 10 and count, and there's only 9 ones.
Well, you dig through. Maybe borrow a dollar from your friend or change or whatever.
And they give you the 9 1 back.
Give them a dollar.
Why don't you just give me a 20? Give me a 20.
So you may don't have all this money, and all you'll see it, you know, whatever.
Well, okay.
And he'll do it.
You can make $200 a night.
And we've even done it while we're talking about.
Well, okay.
And he's a lot of hamburgers to the people. It works like fun. I've never had it fail. I've never, ever had anyone call me.
Well, okay.
That's called short change. Yeah.
You're ready to get out in the streets and make some money. So you're gonna go out and you're feeling good, you're done drinking while you've been putting your makeup on. Hella makeup, you know, get all the lipstick right, but, and some heels.
We go outside and he says, hey, Charlie. And the stretch limo, you know, pulls up, and as it turns out, this guy really is well-to-do. So we zip over to his hotel room. And he says, well, I've never been with anyone like you. He says, but I wanna be. And he kept asking me all night, he says, are you working? Are you working, girl? Are you a hooker? And I said, no, I'm not a hooker. And he said, if you were a hooker, then how much money would you charge? And I said, well, $100. So he goes and he gets in his purse and he gets out $200, you know, 10, 20. And he says, would it be enough? What do you say? For $200, you know, I'll do it. And will tell you they love you and they care about you, then once they get what they want, they're gone. That who's smarter? Who is smarter? The girl that gets paid for it or the one that gives it away for free?
Right here. Watch your head now. Tight fit getting in. All right. I'll just sit right there.
You have the right to remain silent.
Okay, this is case number.
You have the right to remain silent.
You have the right to remain silent. 6-2. There's one spot right here in the middle of the camera. I want you to look right there, and I'll take your picture. Okay, hang on. Are you a regular drug user?
I'm just tired. It's been a long haul from then till now. Hey, I'm a nobody. Life has passed me by. All I want to do is just survive. Is just be able to make it from day to day. Day one to day two. Day three to day four.
Excuse me, sir. Can I speak to you for a minute?
Cigarette?
Yeah. Would you like to have a cup of coffee? Why not? It's a beautiful day today.
We're standing in this line for 45 minutes.
I just had a cup.
To an hour. We're standing in line. Bum and cigarettes.
Excuse me, sir. Excuse me, ma'am. Can I speak to you for a minute? I'm part of the homeless.
Standing in line.
And I was wondering if you could help us out with a little change.
Say, hey, buddy, you got a smoke? Say, hey, buddy, you got a quarter? Hey, buddy, you got a quarter? You got a dime? Standing waiting in line.
We're sorry you didn't have money on that day.
Standing waiting in line at St. Anthony's for 3 hours to eat a little bitty piece of bread.
Nobody cares whether we live or die. Basically, you know, only rich people worry about whether they're going to live forever and ever and ever. Why would I worry about living forever and ever and ever? You know, I'm having too much time, trouble worrying about living from day to day, let alone forever and ever and ever. You know, totally ironic.
That was excerpts from Etiquette of the Undercast, produced by Antenna Theater in Sausalito, California. Shakespeare thought the world was a stage, but more people now act as if it's a marketplace where supply and demand, and sometimes a little chicanery, determine value. Yet in the face of increasing commercialism, Franzell finds hope that art will triumph over money.
I'm sitting in my office one afternoon when a young man I've never seen before pokes his head in the doorway. He's carrying a large, flat cardboard box, large enough to hold 6 extra-large pizzas. "Excuse me," he begins, soft-spoken and polite. "Can you tell me where Molly Simon sits?" "Of course I can. She's in the office next to mine. Her name's on the door, but I don't think of this fact until later." In less than a minute, the guy's back at my gate. "She said I should see you." He enters my sanctum unbidden. He's not delivering pizza. He has pictures by famous artists. He says they were destined for a tenant on the building's first floor, but that when he arrived with the goods, the buyer canceled the order. "I can let you have any one you want for 80% off." It's too late. I'm listening. I just repainted my apartment, and the walls have been looking mighty bare. I'm always interested in bargains. "They were $119. You can have them for $35 each. It's tax deductible, too, because it's for your office." He's smooth as well as polite, a breathless talker. And okay, math's not my strong suit. I can't figure 80% off 119 in my head and come up with 24. But I do know something about art. $119, I almost laugh. For that? He is holding up a large, weepy print of water and a tree that he says is a Monet. It's in a pale blonde frame and wrapped in clear plastic. "My boss charges $119 to hang it," he confides, his voice swimming with sincerity and something else. Awe for this boss of his, who's classy enough to get $119 for hanging pictures. By now I know something is screwy, but there's a renegade inside that squelches the skeptic. Nothing too exciting usually happens in this office. I shuffle a lot of paper, then reshuffle it for the bosses. Here is excitement to trigger the adrenaline. He's turning my modular fishbowl into an open-air market. In full view of whoever might walk by, maybe even the company president. He takes all the pictures out of the box and props them up against things. A chair, file cabinet, the plate glass wall. The guy's chutzpah fascinates me. There are a couple more Monets, dreary in their thrift store incarnation, and a flowery O'Keeffe, also wilted. The one that catches my eye is a Van Gogh. This was such an artist that even a cheap reproduction does him justice. I recognize the clipped, sure brushstrokes in the watery, asymmetric lines of a gray Gothic church set against a blue, blue sky, and in the strong figure of a peasant woman ambling toward it. "You know Monet's water lilies?" the guy asks. "Yeah, I know it. I could have offered it to you, but I just sold my last one. Two women on another floor were fighting over it. One of them reached for it and broke a fingernail. It started to bleed on the picture. They both agreed then that the bleeder should get the picture." He smiles at me conspiratorially. "How could her fingernail bleed?" I ask. "Well, something was bleeding," he assures me, and I take another look at the Van Gogh. "Could you come down a little on the price? I can give you $7 off," he says. "You can have it for $32. Even my math isn't that bad. That's not $7 off of $35. It's $7 off of $39, he informs me right back. "We used to charge $39. This is all very confusing and happening too fast. But I write a check and he writes a receipt in less time than it takes security to appear and escort him away. "You mean you bought it?" comes the double entendre of the year from a coworker who arrives at my desk in security's wake. "It's a scam," says my friend. "When I saw him with that box, I called security. They drop these guys off and they work the building." I knew that, didn't I? On some level, I know mild-mannered guys with creative math skills don't just wander into office buildings with close-out specials on art. Then why do I suddenly feel exploited, violated almost, now that his visit is settling in around me? If the guy lied about some things, maybe everything's a crock. What if it isn't even a real fake Van Gogh? "It's not like he robbed you," my friend says consolingly after he's finished laughing. "It's just another way to make a buck. At least you got the picture." But I don't like the picture anymore. I stash it in a corner for 2 weeks before I work up an urge to hang it. It's definitely office art, I decide. I wouldn't want something purchased under those circumstances in my home. It begins to grow on me again. I'm not crazy about the frame, which is gold and kind of spray-painted tacky. But I like looking up from my computer at the picture. I like its bold colors, its comforting depth, its hint of a great artist's soul. When I look at the picture now, I can almost understand why I didn't hear the salesman's lies. Not long after it goes up, my boss stops by my office. "Oh," he says, impressed, "a Van Gogh." This is Fran Zell counting my change for Mind's Eye Radio.
Perhaps Mark Twain said it best when he wrote, "The holy passion of friendship is so loyal and enduring that it will last through a whole lifetime, if not asked to lend money." Karen Schultz shares her hard-earned lessons about the intermingling of money with relatives and friends.
You know the old saying about not mixing money with family or friends? Well, it's old and still around for a reason. Forget about mixing your Ben Franklin's, or in my case, George Washington's, with your Uncle Frank, unless you're ready for a whole lot of relationship strain. Have you ever noticed the color of money is the same as envy? Trust me, there's a connection here. However, money's not the root of evil, ego is. And what a better way to get the id going than to tell its owner they're not complete without that new car, bigger house, or high-tech equipment. You're not the only one watching those BMW commercials. Your friends and family are too. And they often expect your help fulfilling their American dream. So you find yourself buying stuff you've never needed for their kids' school fund, or worse yet, Avon. And how about those candle parties? I went to one last summer at my friend's new house. with 6 bedrooms. I bought 11 vanilla scented to help them with their decorating. Sometimes the friendly investments escalate and you get involved in the family business scheme. And you ask yourself how it ever got to this. You just wanted to be a good friend, friend-in-law, or friend of friend. You may even be a bit PO'd for ever getting involved in this money business. Perhaps you blame your friend for your new understanding of their strange relationship with money, and you're kind of grossed out that they see money as happiness, security, love, or some other fun thing. Perhaps you realize you fed their ego's lust for the goodies, and like a good therapy patient, you wonder what you could do better in the future. My friend, I offer you my own lesson. Tough love is the answer. Not for your friends and family, but for you. Unless you're willing to learn about the insecurities money hides, don't use it to fuel your own. You thought giving money meant you were a good friend, lover, or brother. No, you were just the dupe your family thought you were for being guilted into thinking money meant anything more than a tool of exchange. So the next time brother wants a dime, give it to him. Knowing all it means is one less dime for you. And if you can't, don't. And by the way, if you're the one asking for the money, your friends and family have just been warned. This is Karen Schultz for Mind's Eye Radio.
You've been listening to Your Money and Your Life on Mind's Eye Radio, written by the members of the Mind's Eye Radio Collective in Madison, Wisconsin. The show was produced by Kelly Warren and co-produced by Sue Renard. Contributing writers include Esther Cameron, Gay Davidson-Zilski, Dick Radke, Fran Rahl, Sue Renard, Karen Schultz, Paul Thompson, Mark von Karstedt, Kelly Warren, Greg Willard, Jackie Wilson, and Fran Zell. The Mind's Eye players include Jody Cohen, Dave Balsiker, Sue Renard, and me, Cole Hornaday. Original music by Barbara Chusett. Thanks to Antenna Theater of Sausalito, California, for their excerpts from Etiquette of the Undercast. If you would like a copy of this show, or would like more information about Mind's Eye Radio, call 608-256-6525. I'm Cole Hornaday, poor in pocket, rich in heart, determined to die with the most toys. Thank you.